Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign, offering crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com.
This is the November 5 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. A very unique program coming your way. Our guests, Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson and Dan Zwicker of Zwicker Consulting. Don't forget to visit our website at willag.org. Sign up for your tickets for the Farm Assets Conference. All the details are on both sites, willag.org or farmassetsconference.com. Tickets are just $30. You should buy them now. The conference comes up at the end of this month, the Tuesday prior to Thanksgiving. Commodity Week with Dan Zwicker and Jackie Vakes in a moment.
Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's Ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
Jackie, I think I'd like to start with you. You made a visit to Chicago in the last couple of weeks up to the USDA's data users group meeting. You made a presentation there as well. You've been wanting to talk a little bit about it with us on air. I think this is a perfect time to do that. Tell me about the presentation and the USDA's data user group meeting as well.
Well, I think, you know, let's start with the USDA data users meeting. It was probably one of the best I've attended in all these years. Tremendous amount of questions and a very open discussion about things that we like or we don't like about what's going on with them. One of the things that has bothered me this year especially is that grain inspections just don't match up. And so Mike Lynch, who's the head of the grain of AMS, you know, USDA does not actually create those numbers. They come from the Grain Council, and I asked him if he could contact them and add the rail numbers to it. Because, you know, years ago, it was very, you know, just having shipping numbers made a lot of sense. But now, you know, we rail a lot of grain, Mexico being our number one buyer of corn, across the borders to Mexico and up into Canada. And the same thing, you know, when you're looking at cattle inspections. And so they were really open to that. But what we had this year that we've never had before at the USDA data users meeting was a representative from the FSA. And that made us that was really good, because we wanted to know, all right, how current are the numbers? You know, when we get the WASDE report, how current are those numbers compared to the numbers that you're releasing 3 days later? Well, guess what? The WASDE numbers are more current. The FSA numbers that they released 3 days later are from the first of the month. And so I don't know if it'll fly or not, but one of my suggestions that I made was that they release them both on the same day, current data. On the same day, you know, in other words, when WASDE comes out at 11 o'clock, FSA numbers come out at 11 o'clock also, and so that we know what numbers are actually being used. Now, whether that'll ever happen and if they can combine that, I don't know. But I can tell you that it was a very active meeting. It was probably, like I said, one of the best that I've been to in a long time, very open. I think that there were 8 heads of the departments there, and, you know, they're more than willing to come up and talk to a person about why you ask what you ask, if it needs to go deeper in depth. And so I was kind of impressed. And then the following day I had an opportunity to do a presentation on Brazil. And that was really exciting in so very many ways, because I didn't realize how many people didn't really get it, I guess. You know, we've been to Brazil. Brazil's as big as the entire United States. And so we kind of learned that, but I thought one of the most interesting things that probably people were flabbergasted by was that if Brazil increases its bean production by 4.8 million metric tons, that's 169 million bushels of beans they increase in 1 year. That's equivalent to over 10% of what we anticipate increasing for or exporting for this whole year. And being able to show them the pictures and how much they've improved some of their infrastructure in the northern arc, where there are three, I think maybe four, facilities open. There'll be 7 facilities, and it'll have an impact on not only the movement of beans and corn, but it'll also have an impact on the movement of beef. And they're going to be expanding an area called the Cerrado, and they intend, that's where 55% of their beef are currently grown. They intend to actually double the number of beef that they grow. So you know what I anticipate? When we were in Brazil, no matter what you ordered, no matter what kind of sandwich you ordered, you got a fried egg on it, okay? Cheese sandwich, steak sandwich, didn't say egg in the menu anywhere, you got a fried egg on it, because that's how they supported their poultry industry. Because we saw one particular poultry place down there, just one place that processed 144 million birds a year. So, you know, if they double their beef and they can't move it all, so does that mean, you know, that a cheese sandwich will now have beef on it?
Eggs would be a lot easier to move than a steak, that's for sure. But
I think you're right, especially if they can take it out of the Northern Arc. But, you know, our biggest issues right now, one of the main things I wanted to point out to people was, well, actually two. One being that China very much wants to get into the International Monetary Fund, and I don't think they're going to be able to do it without allowing the yuan to be able to float against the dollar.
Right.
And, you know, in from a year ago last Thursday, China had only – their prices for commodities had only increased 4%, in contrast to Japan had an increase of 12%. And so I think some of what we're seeing, you know, right now on the heavy you know, record export numbers for beans are possibly that importers over there are expecting them to devalue the yuan again. And that immediately raises the price, and it doesn't help when the dollar is going above 98. And I think the secondary thing is that because the Brazilians and also the Argentinians are paid based on U.S. dollars but in their local currency, the longer their local currency continues to remain to go lower, and as long as the dollar doesn't crumble, and actually the dollar is really helping them out, and I think that's partially what happened today. I think we saw more South American hedging on the board than we normally would otherwise, because they're just going to keep on planting more and more and more, because it really does pay for them to do that.
Dang, you paint a bleak picture, my friend. I guess.
Come on.
Is that right? Well, let me go back and reiterate one thing really quickly. The FSA figures, just to make sure I have this right. When USDA releases the WASDE report, the October number, and previous figures or months in that, they're using the most current figures or day of or day before figures from the Farm Service Agency. However, the reports that we see are like many of the USDA reports, and they are from the first day of the month. So what you asked was that they bring both up to speed and release them at the same time, is my guess. Is that correct?
Right. That is absolutely correct. I think, it, you know, from a transparency standpoint, it's the same issue with grain inspections. You know, let's be transparent about grain inspections. USDA is the one that gets ripped about them, but they're not the ones that actually publish them. You know, they publish them, but they don't create them. So USDA, let's go and get this thing up to speed and make it transparent. We're moving grain not just by boats anymore, we're moving it by rail. Let's make sure that we get this so that it comes out at the end of the year instead of, you know, all of a sudden we get to September 30th and they go, oh my gosh, you know, we made all of our export inspections and all this. You can find all the data. You know, the data is there, but man, I'm telling you, you got to swim through numbers like crazy to get it. How tough is it? And so they on that one, I got a high five on that one, believe it or not.
Well, Jackie, as you hobnob with all these NAS people, what do they actually tell you their mission in life is?
Their mission in life?
Yeah.
Well, number one,
by issuing government reports. What is their mission? What are they trying to accomplish?
Well, there are
Do they know what they're trying to accomplish?
Yes,
can
they
I
do.
Answer
and
that was, question? Because I think
know,
I know
you
what
know.
Know.
One of the things, it's funny, Dan, that you asked that question, because one of the guys, and I know him really well, we all know him really well, was very unhappy, and he was, you know, he wanted to get rid of the crop progress report. Get rid of it. It's worthless. You know, why should you be doing crop conditions at this point in time and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and we all knew that they always published up until 50% of the nation was harvested. And, you know, that's not nearly as relevant as it used to be. And at the same time, I raised my hand and I said, when we talk about the WASDE reports, okay, how many people actually realize that at the back end of the WASDE report, there's a 90% confidence level at a certain deviation? In other words, in a crummy year, you know, like a real rainy year, and we don't have a good idea, just like the farmer doesn't have a good idea what he's going to do, the deviation is going to be very wide. And it's going to be very wide at the beginning of their process of projecting, like, for next year. And
But you're talking about WASDE and NAS. So they're two different groups. I mean, WASDE is the ag economists and professors that sit around and try to determine what demand is. I mean, they take the supply numbers basically from a NAS, and then they try to incorporate what we're going to use. And then they come up with a supply-demand balance sheet. So you're talking about two different groups. You're talking about two different groups.
No. Hang on a second once. WASDE is responsible for all the reports we get until the end of May. Okay? They're doing nothing but projecting. Those are all projections. Those are not coming from NAS.
That's correct.
And then NAS gets involved.
Correct.
Okay?
Right. Well, NAS gives the surveys. When they get their surveys, yes, they are. They're involved. NAS has given them quarterly reports so they can take a gauge on what disappearance is going. They get the planting intentions number in March. So NAS is involved all along, you know.
Well, go back to your original question. Okay, let's go back to your original question as to what is NAS's mission, okay? Number one, I would have to say it probably depends on the director. Our previous director, which I'm very glad is gone, and that's not – I'm not talking about Joe Kursaki. I'm talking about the director of NAS, the head of NAS. I'm really glad is gone because the attitude there was they're nothing more than numbers crunchers is all they are. That's their – you know, that's their whole mission in life is to create statistics. And, the current people – and you could tell such a difference this year compared to last – compared to when – she was still around, on their desire to want to be able to get these things to be much more accurate. But we have to take into account the accurate number has to come in on the farm side too.
Oh.
And one of the problems,
I got to say, I disagree with you.
Let's not give the University of Illinois explanation here.
I'm not going to get the U of I or myself in trouble. But their mission is the collection of data and to make it as and to roll both of them together to make it as accurate as possible. And when they find the inaccuracies, and in fact, they have in the past commissioned, for instance, the Ag Economist here on campus to look at reports and say, are there things that are wrong in these reports? Do we need to improve them in some way? Are they accurate as they are at the moment? And it's not about what the improvements, I would think that the Ag Economist would give them suggestions as to what improvements might be made, but it's about whether the statistical backdrop is accurate enough to get a really good pull on the numbers. And it's surprising, and I would you'd have to talk to a mathematician or one of the economists by how little you have to actually pull in order to get an accurate number. However, given that, for instance, the grain stocks numbers, when they pull those numbers and you have everybody reporting, that's a census.
Yeah.
That's not a survey, that's not an estimate. That one is a census, and that's done by USDA NAS.
That's right. It's an estimated census.
They have to estimate the flip side of it. They have to estimate what's on farm.
Now you're touching on, Todd, some of the problems that exist from the standpoint of the FSA. You know, not all farmers, whether we under believe it or not all farmers participate in the farm program or anything like that. And so when it comes to acreage and getting the accuracy levels on that guy from FSA we were talking about, one of the questions that was asked I thought was really good. You know, what on an average, what would you say would be the percentage of participation? You know, and he said right now, you know, with this new farm bill, somewhere between probably 85% and 90% participation. That's about it. So you got a 10% hanging out there. Now, how many acres is that? Nobody knows. Where are the acres located? I don't have a clue. But, you know, it does make it tougher, and that's why that January report is the final for the year.
Well, this is what gets – now, see, I know I'm going to get in trouble. All of my PhD friends and university professors, they're going to say, now you're in a hoot owl, and that's why I'm down here in Texas, is kind of their general purpose in life is to basically provide agribusiness with the supply, and they estimate what the demand is going to be so agribusiness can plan and have the upper hand when it comes to price structure. I think it's a total disadvantage to farmer. It takes away marketing opportunities away from farmer, and it gives the hand to agribusiness or the end users of ag commodities. Now, like I said, I know I'm in trouble. Yeah.
No, no. So here's the deal, Dan. If that was the case, why would there be such a big push for big data, for collection and use of data from the farm?
Right.
And we'll take this up, and I'm going to roll this right into the Farm Assets Conference, because I think everybody ought to come to the Farm Assets Conference. And that's November the 24th. You can go to farmassetsconference.com. We're going to talk a little bit about big data, but if you think about what the sensors on your planter and your combine can do, the data that they're collecting and how that can be aggregated with the data that's collected from everybody else, potentially in real time, somebody's going to have a huge advantage.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's not going to be the farmer. We know that.
Well,
the farmer has been at.
But I think that you've got to understand who owns the data and where it's going.
Well, how would you like to be playing poker, and every time you get three aces, somebody hollers, "Oh, Todd's got three aces over there." I mean, that's about the way USDA operates with all of their reports. They constantly are coming out with numbers and taking suspense or uncertainty out of the marketplace, and that plays into the advantage of the end user. It does not play to the advantage of the producer.
Well, everybody has equal access to the reports, relatively speaking. Why would that be the case, that it would add to the suspense? I mean, do you believe then that the farmer at the county level understands what's being produced all across the state, across the USA, across the planet?
When USDA comes out in August 1st with an estimate, 167.4 bushels per acre on corn, it basically pulls the plug out of any kind of suspense of what the size of the crop is, at least for that period of time. Now, if they would come out and say, okay, the crop, based upon August 1 conditions, and depending upon what the weather is going to be over the next 30 days or 60 days, we think the national average yield can fall between 165 and maybe 170. Now, granted, I know that the trade is going to go right to the midpoint of it, but let them trade the midpoint.
No, this is that you rolled right the low end.
Let them trade the low end. If they want to trade the high end.
Well, let me get in here a second, okay? This is exactly what I brought up at the data user meeting. You just rolled right into it. I said, when you look at that 90% confidence and a deviation of this, when you're publishing numbers, why aren't you publishing the range? You know, just like we do with when you look at the price, we now have a price range. That comes because of data users who have begged to get that. And I said, you need to do the very same thing
rather than having the midpoint for the national
average
cash price.
Rather than having the midpoint, you can use the midpoint if you want to, because you have to have something to use for the...
Well, that's the way with the ag economists on the World Board, when they project demand 12 months ahead of time. I think it's ridiculous that they come out that corn exports are going to be 1.875 billion bushels a whole year in advance. They should say, well, based upon what world production is, and if we have an average crop, then our exports ought to fall between 1.625 and 1.925, and let the trade work the range. Let the market and work the range.
And if
instead
and
of
if
them
you
coming
look
out
at the
with
deviation,
all the numbers.
It's a matter of moving the numbers around in the reports, meaning moving them where moving the deviation down at the bottom into the into the rest of the report. Into
when
the,
they put
into
in 1.85 billion, there was a 10% deviation, meaning it could be 10% bigger than that or 10% lower than that. That's what I want them to publish. So that this middle number, all of this about how many bushels per acre the USDA put out ends when you show the deviation. Because when you see the deviation says it could be as big as 1.98, you know, or it could be as little as 1.7, and people would have a range to trade, and it would make so much more sense, you know. And you know, these guys are statisticians. They don't think about that. They're not traders, okay? They're not traders at all. And so, you know, they were like, well, you know, all of that stuff, Jackie, is at the bottom of the report. And I turned around, and I'm sitting in a room that's filled with, well, we were above capacity this year, so we had like 125 different representatives there. I turned around, and I looked around the room, and I said, how many of you know that 90% deviation is there? Would you be willing to raise your hands? There was one other person in the room. And so, you know, I mean, I said to them, put it at the front of the report. Put right up at the front of the report when you let it out so people have access to that. I said, we need to have more transparency here, and we need to have people understand that when you put these numbers out, that is a mid-range number. That there's a deviation on that. How can the USDA know what the farmer's going to do? They haven't got a clue. They can look back over the last 5 years and make a guess, but it's going to have
well,
to have a deviation.
Nobody in Washington knows what they're doing. We know that. But
well,
know.
Yeah.
But I do agree with whoever you said was made the comment that they have too many reports. I definitely in that camp. We got way too many reports. We got weekly crop reports. We got weekly inspection reports. We got weekly export sales reports. I mean, there's a report every week USDA is issuing. And, I mean, I don't see the sense in having that many USDA reports. Let the market work it. Now, I understand you have to have reports so the market kind of has an idea. But I think when you have all these reports, you take suspense out of the market, and therefore you take marketing opportunities away from farmers, and that gives the end user the advantage in positioning their position for the coming year.
You know, Dan,
and
I've
worked on the end user side. I know how they play. USDA's reports are not helpful to farmers. They're more helpful to the end user.
That was especially true when I started in this business 18 years ago. Okay, I've been involved 36 years in using the other side, you know, the end user side as well as this side. And 18 years ago, you could see exactly what was going on. The futures went up, the basis went down. The basis went up, the futures went down. And the commercials had control. Why do you think they hate the funds? Why do you think they hate the index funds? Because the index funds have come in and taken the place of the farmer. And now they've got another dimension that's added to this is the black box or the algorithmic trading. And that now is added to it. So, you know, why do I get surveyed all the time by people ahead of these WASD reports as to what my thoughts are? And why are 10 or 12 or 15 other people being asked the same thing? It's all published before the report ever hits the deck. And, you know, from taking away the opportunity for the farmer, you know, I got farmers right now, guys that are calling up saying, we need to do something on 17. We need to get going on 17. We've been working a year ahead. The availability is there for people to do it. It's one of those things. It's just like when we saw some of the blow-ups in some of the trading firms, you know, the worst part about that was the people who need to hedge the most now even have more of an excuse not to do it. You know, and I think that's the same thing we're looking at here. The commercial.
Well,
you know,
it's interesting. When I first got started in this business many, many moons ago, the general philosophy was to get government out of agriculture. I mean, that was the stated goal of American Farm Bureau Federation. All the way down to the county level is to get government out. I remember Charlie Schumann from Sullivan, Illinois, that was president of AFBF, and, you know, that's all he talked about was get government out of agriculture. Well, now we're in a phase that all of your farm leaders now turn toward government for support and help. It's just did a total flip-flop, and I think this is what's wrong with our current, why we're going to have cheap prices, and we could have cheap prices for a long period. I really do, because farm programs basically are basically subsidies driven, and if you want more of something, all you have to do is subsidize it, and that is why we're going to see constant overproduction of corn, soybeans, and wheat here in the United States, and then that's going to feed on into worldwide too. You're going to see we're in a period of overproduction of ag commodities, and that's why the market is so deflationary, you know. So,
if you want
more of some, just subsidize it, and you'll get it. And that's exactly what we have today.
Yeah, I think, though, when you look at it, Dan, on one respect, you know, when I remember that period in time when everybody was saying, you know, get government completely out, especially in 1996, the Farm Bill, right? And I think the realization became – it became more clear that this is not just about the U.S., this is about the world. And all of a sudden they realized that, you know, they kind of can't get the government totally out of it in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think it's interesting the reaction that's going on now that they're talking about reducing the subsidies to the crop insurance, you know, and things like that. Well, I mean, they've increased those things like crazy over these last number of years. You knew it was going to come at some point in time. And I think the thing that's going to really make the change is we have a lot. I think we have some major challenges ahead of you. I agree 1,000% that we could be headed for much lower prices over a number of years now, unless we really see the dollar start to fall. Because I think when you look at the bigger picture, as there's more infrastructure and as the arc opens up more and more down in Brazil, and they have more and more reason to produce more and more beans, suddenly, our bean prices, you know, bean prices are going to really come under fire. And now,
well, the dollar will fall by itself, by its own weight, once China is allowed into the international monetary system. Once the Japanese yuan is recognized as a world reserve currency, all of the capital around the world will want to buy the yuan. They'll want to invest in China. So all of your economic growth and everything will be in China, and there'll be so many dollars floating around from the last, you know, 10 years of printing dollars at 0% interest rate that you'll have to raise interest rates 25% to put the brakes on the dollar. So I ain't too worried. The dollar will eventually fall apart. It's just a matter of when they agree to put China as a reserve currency. Then all of the speculative money will move to China. It'll all go into China.
And, well, that's why they want to get in.
That's why China wants to lower their yuan, because they know once they go to a free market, that yuan will strengthen in value. So they wanted to start at a much lower level than what it's starting at now.
That's exactly right. And the biggest question that there is, okay, and if you look at some of the other world economies that have just started to float against the U.S. dollar, they've had tremendous problems. And so the key will be, where does the yuan truly fit? Where, you know, where does it actually come in here against the U.S. dollar? You know, and if you talk about raising your prices from a 4% increase to a 12% increase on the import side, that's a huge thing for us. You know, from the export side, on their other side, and investment side, man, I'm 1,000% with you. They're going to invest over there like crazy. That's why they want to get in so doggone bad, you know, because.
And they will. They're the second largest economy in the world, so they will be eventually recognized as a world currency. It's just a matter of when that's going to happen.
Oh, I don't think they're going to be the world currency. I think they're going to be allowed into the
IMF. No, they'll be recognized as a world reserve currency.
Yeah.
Right now,
only if they get into the intermonetary fund currency basket.
That's coming. You can't stop them from being part of the international economy.
But the only way they can do it is to allow it to float against the dollar. they are not going to become the dollar. They are going to become a part of the basket that floats.
No, the dollar is, well, right now the dollar is 50% of the reserve currencies floating around the world. What will happen is when China is recognized as a reserve currency, when the yuan is a reserve currency, it'll come out of the dollar's hide. So the dollar's share of the world reserve currency may fall back to 40% or 35%. And that's what will generate selling the dollars, because they'll want to sell dollars and buy yuans with that. And that's what will create the weakness in the dollar.
It's the same type of thing that when you saw the euro come out in the European Union, you know, it was sell the dollar and buy the euro. And that was a smart thing for a period of time. And then it went to pieces. But, you know, it's a – and so I think –
well,
you know,
it's clear that the euro was a disaster. I mean, you can see that. And that's part of the problem we've got right now in world currency markets, is the euro is a total disaster. And now you've got fears that Germany is going to go into civil war because of all the immigrants that are coming across. So that's, you know, you can see a lot of turbulence in Europe, and that's why the currency markets are they're very volatile over here, at least for right now. But they are a negative influence, but we also have to recognize that the high prices that we had between 08 and 2012 increased world production of farmland by millions and millions of acres, and those acres are not going to go out of production anytime soon.
Nope. There's only going to be more millions of acres, you know, and that is the problem. If we never would have gone above 450 for corn, we probably wouldn't be having such a major discussion, you know, from that standpoint, because you would not have seen the expansion. But the way things are is the way things are. And so, you know, the thing that's interesting here, you know, from the Fed standpoint is you know, the Fed used to be able to really, you know, they started your recessions, they ended your recessions, you know, they control inflation pretty much. You know, are we too hot? We got to slow them down. Are we too slow? We got to heat them up. But, you know, in a mature economy like we have versus a developing economy, I don't think they have the influence they used to have. You look at Japan, you know, years of zero interest rates, and they're still struggling to grow. And so, you know, I think it's going to be there's a lot of new normals coming and a lot of challenges, but you know, that means for opportunity. And so, you know, for the farmer, he's got to take the bull by the horns, as far as I'm concerned, and say, hey, I can see great prices further out. I'm going to do something to protect it, you know, and we go from there. And that's all we can. I mean, the reality is we know the cattle market here, with as big as JBS is, you know, it's going to continue to get bigger. We're going to have Brazilian cattle coming in here. There's no question about that against our cattle. We just have to figure out how to work with it.
Well, I thought all these world trade agreements that everybody was promoting and signing were supposed to be beneficial to the United States.
Yeah, well, let's say. Well, you know, I would put that on the same par as when I remember Nancy Pelosi saying, we'll read it later. We're going to sign it now, but we'll read it later.
Yeah.
I think there have been some things that are okay, but there have been numbers of things that are not okay. And so,
that's what's wrong with world trade agreements are really not worth more than the paper they're printed on, is because it all depends upon the value of the currency of the country at any time anyway.
Yeah.
And when you get into an agreement, that basically says that you're negotiating trade. You're basically the players, the people that's contributed to the right people, get to sit at the table and say, okay, if you buy so many airplanes from Boeing, then we'll buy so many bombs from here. So it's all a negotiated trade. It's not free trade. And then the small guy gets caught in the middle of that wind.
Well, and that's really hard. And I think one of the big pushes for China, you know, to I don't know if you saw this, Dan, you probably did, but President Xi came out on Tuesday, you know, and he said they need at least 6.5% economic growth just to become moderately prosperous. Moderately prosperous. And so the wild card, as far as I'm concerned, when you look at like corn, is, you know, they were supporting corn at $8.80. Now they dropped it to $8. You can still import our corn for less than what you can buy it from them.
Well, there's no doubt the Chinese economy has to grow at a faster rate than what it has
to bring back the demand. And I think that will eventually come, that's coming, but it's not going to come right tomorrow, but it's coming. We're growing at what, 1% or 2%, or are we growing at a negative 2%? What are we at in the United States?
Well, we're growing probably at about a 2% level. We're just growing in different areas. It's like anything else. When we went into the recession, what happened to the housing area? It went to hell, right? So the construction workers got laid off. These guys got laid off. These guys got laid off. And then a different section comes in, and that section prospers, perhaps. So it's kind of a balancing act. But I saw a really interesting chart when I was in Chicago. And actually, if you looked at all the major, the major major countries, China's big deviation, like in their stock market, was just huge. It was just from everybody else, and everybody else basically has been relatively within a relatively small range, for a long, long time, a very stable situation, and so a correction coming out of China was not a big surprise at all. But it was just a situation where I think, rather than expecting to see 2 or 3% growth or 4% growth from countries like ours, I believe it's unrealistic, partly due to technology, and partly due to the fact that we have corporations that now say, hey, guy, that person next to you, I just laid him off, but you're going to do his job now. And because of all of the costs that are getting to be, things are getting more expensive. And so I think that it's going to be interesting. There's opportunity out there like crazy for everybody. It's just a matter of how you want to handle it, I guess, that's my opinion. That's only my opinion.
Todd, what happened to you, Todd?
Did we put you to sleep, Todd?
I think I asked a question 36 minutes ago. I can't remember.
Oh, okay.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate it a lot. I think we did the trick.
Great talking with you, Dan. Okay. Looking forward to seeing you.
Yeah, have a good weekend. Have a good rainy weekend up there.
Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's Ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.